Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and sometimes more than daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. We are now in the second stage of the Labour leadership contest. Nominations have opened when it comes to affiliate groups and constituency Labour parties as to who they want to be the next leader. Keir Starmer looks the most assured of succeeding through to the membership round. Rebecca Long-Bailey also looks in a good place. And Lisa Nandy has surprised some by winning the backing of one union, and there's talk that she could win another and get there quite easily, or at least ahead of schedule. Today, Lisa Nandy has been giving a speech where she's trying to flesh out her vision for the country were she to be Labour leader. Isabel, it's fair to say that Lisa Nandy as a candidate is one that I think probably members of the public know less about. She's seen as being on the soft left in terms of Labour. Some think that as the MP for Wigan, she could have a blue Labour tilt. But she's given a speech today and she's also been talking about her views. And one of the things that's come up is the fact that she thinks freedom of movement should continue. So what does that tell us about her pitch?
Well, that's not particularly blue Labour. If people are sort of trying to pigeonhole her as being one sort of candidate or another. And it has upset some people who think that talking enthusiastically about freedom of movement is the sort of thing that's disconnected Labour from its working class communities in the north. And it was an interesting speech just on her sort of commitment to internationalism more generally, a kind of rejection of the Corbynite way of basically befriending anyone who's our enemy is therefore Corbyn's friend. And she criticised the way in which, for instance, the Labour Party had responded to the Salisbury attack. And she is, I think, James has said this on previous podcasts as well, I think she's probably the most interesting of the Labour leadership candidates, because though she is, her views aren't as well known perhaps as Jess Phillips, she's not like Keir Starmer, where even when you sort of try to delve into those views, you're still not sure. She's got a lot of, I don't want to say ideological underpinning, but she's got a lot of political thinking behind her, not just on towns, which everyone sort of goes on about, but on how we relate to Britain's place in the world, how that's explained to your constituents who are worried about immigration and so on. But she's not dogmatic. And in fact, there isn't really anyone in this contest now who is particularly dogmatic. I was just talking to an MP who was saying that they were glad that actually most of them have got, if not an entirely blank sheet of paper, lots of blank spaces. It means that Labour will be electing a leader who's prepared to listen, hopefully, to those in the wider party rather than, as Jeremy Corbyn has for the past few years, basically continuing with the ideas that he formulated 20 years ago.
Now, James, the Lisa Nandy route to victory, if we want to get ahead of ourselves, involves passing this stage and getting to the membership, and then if you speak to those around Lisa Nandy, it relies quite heavily on second preference votes. So it's a preferential voting system when it comes to the membership. Every person who gets to vote does a first preference and second preference. And the idea is, if, say, someone like Emily Thornberry was knocked out, or even Rebecca Long-Bailey, if their second preference, those who backed them, went to Lisa Nandy, she could squeeze ahead and perhaps be a real threat to Keir Starmer. Do you think Lisa Nandy is someone who would worry the Tories as Labour leader?
I think that her diagnosis of why Labour lost the election is better than any of the other candidates, and therefore more alarming, not Lisa Nandy as a person, but that understanding is more alarming to the Tories. I thought today's speech, though, was a real misstep by her, because party leadership contests are always about, you know, how much do you appeal to the electorate, how much do you think about the wider electorate. Today's speech was very much aimed at the electorate, because I think it frankly slightly beggars belief to say that you've got to listen to towns, to places that have stopped voting Labour, these red wall seats that went Tory, and then turn around and say, and I'm a passionate believer in free movement and I want it to continue. There's a kind of weird line in there when she says that she understands these places better than Boris Johnson, they want it to continue. Well, if they wanted to continue, why did so many of them vote for Brexit? And why did so many of them break the habit of a lifetime and vote Tory in 2019. And it makes it sound like she wants to listen to people, but it's like one of those listening sessions where someone listens to what you have to say and then gets up and says, that's great, I'm really glad I've listened to you, and I'm now going to carry on doing exactly the same thing that I was doing before. I think this is a big blunder, because while I can understand it in terms of a direction of a Labour leadership race, the idea that Labour are going to put up another leader who the Tories will just be able to bash over the head on free movement every day of the week, it's just daft. You'd be much better off fudging this question right now rather than wading into it. I think this also comes back to, I think, a very good point made in Daniel Finkelstein's column in the Times today, which is, this was about Keir Starmer, Labour are in danger of kind of clinging on to kind of bits of wreckage of EU membership rather than starting to think afresh about where they actually should be positioning themselves for a post-Brexit era.
So we're not expecting Lisa Nandy to bring her end of freedom of movement mugs anytime soon. But James, is there a single candidate of the five who's hinting at least that they are going to suggest anything other than freedom of movement continuing?
No, because, I mean, the most kind of Brexit curious of the candidates, I suppose you could put it like that, is Rebecca Long-Bailey. But she has come out saying that she's against kind of control. I mean, one of those things that you think that she can't possibly mean, but she's against kind of controls on immigration full stop. So I don't sense that she is about to move into that space. And I think this is, again, this is a challenge for Labour. I think Labour aren't going to win again until they understand that a desire for control of immigration is not only understandable, it is the common ground of British politics. The amount of people who actively believe that not having control of your immigration policy is a positive is very small. Some people are prepared to accept free movement as the price of single market membership. But the idea that it is in and of itself a good is a very niche view.
Isabel, you've been writing on Coffee House about the various leadership teams that have been assembled. Are there any surprises in terms of who these candidates are picking to back them?
Well, I think one of the biggest surprises actually is how far behind in hiring Rebecca Long-Bailey and Emily Thornberry's campaigns are. Now, perhaps the Thornberry campaign being a bit slow to appoint parliamentary chairs and campaign managers and so on is not particularly surprising, given they weren't even sure whether they were going to get over the line on Monday. And so that's where all of their efforts were focused. But for Rebecca Long-Bailey, I mean, she has been mooted as the next Labour leader for years now. And there seems to be some kind of, firstly, an internal tussle within the campaign over, within the existing staff on the campaign, over who's in charge, who's got the greatest influence. And that goes beyond her core team to the various influencers like Len McCluskey and John McDonnell, who want to be able to sort of have power over the message of this campaign. I think there's also the possibility that a lot of people maybe in the Labour Party organisation and perhaps also in Momentum are waiting to move over. So they've got sort of contractual issues, which means that her list of staff and chairs and so on is just really, really short, because they haven't been able to announce anyone yet. And then if you look at the shape of the other campaigns and who the candidates have appointed. So Keir Starmer is clearly going as the unity candidate, because he's managed to appoint, for instance, Kat Fletcher, who was once in the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, which is a Trotskyist organisation, and at the same time also appoint Morgan McSweeney, who worked on Liz Kendall's leadership campaign in 2015. Although, obviously, I don't think they're appointing him for the sort of the percentage boost that that might give them, but more that everyone who worked with him on that campaign said that he was incredibly able and, you know, did everything he could with what ended up being a bit of a disaster. But to have both of those sides represented shows that Keir Starmer is trying to appeal to both sides of the party and to give a message to those in the middle who are just fed up with the factionalism, that he is basically able to speak to both and he's got messages from both sides. And then Lisa Nandy's team seems to be dominated by sort of Milibandite people. There are lots of people who were in Labour HQ during the 2015 election, for instance. I mean, there's Matthew McGregor, who worked on digital strategy for the 2012 Obama campaign, but also was the digital attack dog who was supposed to help Miliband win in the 2015 election. There's quite a few other ex-Miliband type figures as well. So that shows where her support has come from also from MPs. And then if you look at Jess Phillips, I mean, she's hired lots of women, which isn't a surprise given the issues she's campaigned on and how she sort of pitches herself. She's also made one really interesting hire, which is Blair McDougall is going to be advising her on the union. And he was, he ran the Better Together campaign. He was chief strategist in that campaign in the 2014 Scottish referendum. To my knowledge, this is the only appointment that's been made by any of the campaigns that actually refers to Scotland. And it's something you talk to MPs, not just those who are left or who have just lost their seats in Scotland, but those who have got an eye to Labour actually winning at some point in the future. And they say, well, you know, we've got to make Scotland a key part of this, but no one's really bringing it up at the moment in the campaign.
Now, in part because of all that, the fact that we have this Labour leadership contest ongoing, Prime Minister's Questions has turned into a somewhat lacklustre affair. You have Boris Johnson with his majority of 80, but up against Jeremy Corbyn. In today's exchange, the NHS came up. At one point, Jeremy Corbyn even referred to his party's 2019 manifesto. But James, the peg for this is the fact that the Tories are planning to put in law the funding they're going to put in the NHS. Is this just a gimmick in the sense that this funding is coming to them anyway?
Yes, I mean, it is a gimmick. All of these... I think one of the things about this government is the debt it owes to, New Labour, essentially. I mean, remember, was Boris Johnson doing my job at that point? This was very much the era in which both Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings cut their political teeth. And this is a kind of classic New Labour gimmick. You're planning to do something anyway, you put it in law, and that gets you an extra kind of set of headlines. It is a gimmick, but it is quite an effective gimmick in that it gets them to talk again about, you know, how they are putting huge amounts of money into the NHS. And, you know, given that one of their big political, perhaps their most audacious political aim over the next term is to, at the end of it, be able to turn around and have voters think of the NHS as neutral for the Tories or maybe even a positive, then, you know, you can see how that works for them.
Now, the other piece of news on the government side is that of a bailout of Flybe, the regional air company. Isabel, the government intervening, big sums of money. It's not a typical Tory story, is it? So what's going on?
No, and it's in real opposition to the sort of economics that Sajid Javid has espoused over the past few years as well. You've previously seen the government quite, not relaxed, but feeling committed to the idea that if big organisations fail, then that's just the way that the market works. And in this case, I think there's been a lot of pressure, particularly from Conservative MPs whose constituencies are affected by the prospect of the Flybe collapse. So those in the southwest, in particular, were arguing very forcefully in the chamber earlier this week about the fact that they're, you know, these aren't jet set constituents. These are people who are just trying to get around various bits of the country for work and who really rely on regional airports and on Flybe's service in particular. But it does also show that this, you know, this Boris Johnson government is not an ideological government. It doesn't set a way of operating and then stick to it. It sort of moves with the circumstances.
James, do you think it's fair to say that they moved the geography on this in the sense that when this government is going to be making decisions on spending, a lot of it does relate to the Midlands and the North and keeping those types of seats, if you think about their level up plans?
Yeah, I think this isn't a straight bailout, and it isn't as much as Flybe itself wanted in terms of APD. But I think it is, you are yourself and both right on this point, which is, you know, Isabel is right, but basically the regional connectivity point, it would have probably been a very bad look for them at this moment to have said, oh, regional airport's going to end up going to the wall because the big regional carrier Flybe is going. And Katie, I think you're right, they worried about that it would contradict all of their rhetoric. I do think, though, that this does suggest something else, which is there is an interesting question, which is how big an impact is this net zero by 2050 target actually going to have on government policy? Because I think you can make a defence of flying from Belfast to the rest of the UK. You can make a defence of flying from kind of London to Aberdeen or Fort William, or from Cornwall up into the rest of the country. But a lot of the rest of these journeys, you know, frankly, Manchester to London should, for environmental reasons, be done by train, not plane. And the net zero by 2050 was one of those classic things voted through without, you know, I'm not even sure there was a vote on it, you know, carried through the Commons on massive consensus, everyone kind of getting all kind of Greta Thunberg about it all. And no one really examining the case, because if you are genuinely serious about getting emissions down to zero by net zero by 2050, then we really shouldn't be trying to save internal flights within the UK, or with the exception of a couple of routes. I mean, this is very surprising. And I think this is going to be a big question mark about over the next few years, which is, you know, is this net zero by 2050 one of those targets that politicians very happily vote for, because they won't be, you know, I don't think even the most optimistic member of Boris Johnson's cabinet thinks that this government is still going to be in place by 2050. And so, you know, you can blithely vote for something because you won't be held accountable for it when the time comes. Or is this actually a policy objective which will lead to kind of tough choices being made and people saying, no, actually, we actively want to dissuade people from flying from Newcastle to London, for example?
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. And we are going to plug you an event, but it's not the event we plugged you the last time around. We're going to mix things up slightly. So this event coming up is it time to offer amnesty to Britain's illegal immigrants? A discussion featuring Fraser Nelson and Kate Andrews, our new economics correspondent, along with a host of other guests. That will take place on the 25th of February at the Emmanuel Centre. And to buy yourself a ticket, just go to www.spectator.co.uk/amnesty podcast.